Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Carrie Sheehan. I represent the plaintiff appellant Ricky Davis, Sharonda Davis, his next best friend of minor child MD. We're here today on bringing up the district court's denial or granting of the motion for summary judgment of the defendant in this case and disallowing our equal protection claims under 42-1983, due process claims, failure to train, and Title IX claim. So that's why we are here today. I'd like to first start with the Title IX claim under the Educational Amendments of 1972. In this case, we needed to prove three things for our claim to go forward as there's material issues of fact: that there was an offensive contact, an educational benefit that was denied, that it was based on some type of sex-related thing, either a sexual desire or a stereotype between males, females, something of that nature.
What? The third thing, what?
Like a stereotype between males and females, like you're being discriminated against based on a stereotype. Like, say you're a male and other males are discriminating against you because you're weaker or you're more artistic or you have more feminine qualities. That is something that is actionable under Title IX.
Was he, what do they call him, MD? Mm-hmm. Was he already in some category of special education?
He was lower on the grades-wise. He was not classified as any special education type of student. He did not make good grades, though. His grades were not even good enough for him to make the basketball team, which is why he was a manager of the freshman basketball team at the time this occurred.
He was a manager of the freshman team?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And at the time this occurred, when he was doing the manager, he would go into the locker room before practices after their sixth-period class or their last class of the day to get ready to get everything out. And the assaults occurred during that time, and then also on the buses, or on the bus ride back from an away game from Terre Haute South. For that, the stereotype basis, he was, like I said, just a freshman. He was didn't have the grades. Some of the coaches gave testimony they didn't have the talent either to make the team at that time, and it was senior kids that were discriminating against him or harassing him during these events.
No, the seniors dragged him into the shower at one point?
Yes, they dragged him into the shower, yes.
Was this after he announced that he had had sex with some girl in the shower in the school?
Yes, Your Honor. MD had bragged to the senior boys, since they had been harassing him, that he had sex with a girl in the locker room shower in the high school. After that, three of the perpetrators dragged him into the shower, turned him on his side, anally penetrated him through his clothes. He was screaming, "Stop," based on his testimony. And they did not stop. Once they stopped after they got bored, after they took turns of harassing him at that point. Now, another thing we have to prove under Title IX is actual knowledge, that the school, coaches, or someone in a position had actual knowledge that these events were occurring and did nothing. And that's where it's a big contested point in this case, especially that the defendant will try to say that we have not proven that element. When these came to light with the school, when they started a public investigation, different statements of boys were taken by Assistant Principal Kevin Gallman. He was in charge of doing the investigative interviews. Several students, which are attached to his deposition, stated that the coaches knew. They laughed about it. They did nothing about it. They said, "Oh, you know, that sucks. They got you. That stinks." They said, "Stop the grab-assing. Stop doing this type of conduct." But they never disciplined these boys. They never did anything of that nature.
Are you talking about the same seniors?
Same seniors.
That it was what everybody knew they were?
Yes.
Whatever you call it, some kind of a culture or something?
It was the culture of the program. One of the perpetrators, Robert Kissinger, in his statement said that as bad as it sounds, it's just the culture of the program. This is how it goes. He even went on to say in his statement that, you know, it brings us closer together as a team. That's how he categorized the sexual assaults. The penetration through clothing, not through clothing, skin-on-skin contact. They would try to pull down the pants of the victims.
Well, there was no knowledge on the part of the coaching staff or the school administration of that activity until February of 2010, MD reported it to the freshman coach, right?
We would dispute that based on the statement, especially of Oscar Faladin, which is attached to Gallman's deposition since he interviewed him, a minor child, JB, which is a signed affidavit, that another minor child who was assaulted with the initials MF reported it to Coach Vanderberg. Coach Vanderberg said, "Oh, they got you. That stinks."
No, that's what was the date of that?
That was back on January 2nd of 2010.
Okay, so that's a month earlier.
Yes.
And it's a different student.
It's a different student. Same team, same perpetrators, different students. And at that time, after Coach Vanderberg said to the minor child MF, the different student, oh, that stinks, they got you, the seniors...
Was that just a report of gooching, I guess was the name?
Gooching, yes. And gooching is defined as sticking your hands between the butt of another person, sometimes sticking your fingers, trying to anal penetrate them through clothing or not through clothing. They would always try to pull down their pants or their victims before they did this type of conduct. So once that was reported...
Well, is there knowledge that the coaches and the school were aware of this definition that you're giving us? Or did they just... I mean, the question of knowledge is really the critical one here. And so we need to know precisely what they knew about this activity. If they understood only that there was sort of horseplay, locker room horseplay going on, then that's what they thought gooching was, if they didn't know what it really involved until after MD reported exactly what was happening to him, then there can't be any liability here.
Our contention is that they knew what gooching was going on. They called it grab-assing, characterized it, you know, it's just something that goes on during the thing.
That suggests that they didn't know exactly what was happening, that these are actual sexual assaults and not just the locker room horseplay that they referred to by other terms.
Based on the statements, we believe that MF, when he reported it to Coach Vanderberg back on January 2nd, when it happened to him on the bus, they knew what the gooching was. They knew that he had tried to be anally penetrated at that time.
That's what he reported?
He reported to the coaches that they had gooched him or tried to do that.
But he didn't. I mean, he just used that terminology. We don't have anything more than that.
No, when we interviewed the coaches in their depositions, they knew what gooching was at that time, but to my knowledge, I don't remember asking them. I'd have to go back to their depositions to look to see if it was prior to that. But we do believe that they did have knowledge of what those terms mean, especially based on the fact...
Who was it that told the coach it's not a problem?
Excuse me?
When the coach said, when one of the other students was complaining, mm-hmm. he told a coach, and the coach says, well, you know, is it a problem or something? And the guy says, well, it's not a problem. Who said that?
Minor child MF, and that was after an altercation that happened on January 8th.
Yeah.
Minor child MF was retaliated against from the senior perpetrators that he told on January 2nd. They attacked him again in the locker room. One of the seniors held him down while the others tried to gooch him, pull his ear. There's also incidents reported of pulling pubes that were done to other people as well at that time.
Well, I thought that one of them sort of called the coach off, said, you know, it's not a problem.
That would probably be the January 8th one you're referring to. Coach Vanderberg walked into the locker room during the incidents of that fight. He asked what was going on. Minor child MF said, oh, don't worry about it. The coach never inquired further to what had happened into that fight that happened on January 8th.
So that's the should have known type thing.
Yes.
Okay. And then the next one is a few days before some mother called based on, and then everybody jumped on it.
The mother called on February 16th to the school nurse.
So it's about February 10th or so when coach denies it, but supposedly that's when MD said something to that coach.
Yeah, that's
in dispute, but nothing happened between the 10th and the 16th when a mother called, told what her son had told her, and then everybody descended on these guys and they're ultimately suspended and expelled.
That's correct. Nothing happened between February 8th when MD says he reported it to Coach Blanding and February 16th when the mother called the school and they started taking public action at that time to investigate them. Now, I wanted to also address the fact that the defendant had stated in its brief that the statements of these kids were not admissible. We believe that they are admissible under 8036 as business records. Kevin Gallman testified that he was in charge of the investigation, reporting back to the principal as well as to other people of what was going on. The statements were taken. He testified in his deposition, said that he was present during these. Those were his notes on a lot of them. I think there was three that weren't exactly his notes. One from Kissinger and one from Faladin, I think it was. No, Kissinger and Laskowski, Scott Laskowski, excuse me. However, he did testify he was present during those and that someone else was in charge of the note-keeping, and he did testify as to what was said in those meetings.
We've got two problems on this issue. One is waiver, because it wasn't addressed until your reply brief, and the other is that we've got hearsay within hearsay here.
As to the waiver, I think there is a case, I think it was Vespas of City of Portland, that says as long as there is an opportunity and it is part of the record for the other person to rebut it or address it, then it can be addressed up on the district court level of appeals. So we feel that we have not waived it per se, that we should fall under that. That, I mean, the evidence was there. The entire deposition of Kevin Gallman was attached with all these statements to it under the district court record, so it is part of the record. All these statements have been there, not just something newly introduced as we come up here to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals. And what was your other question? I'm sorry.
Hearsay within hearsay.
We would still fall under the business records exception that, you know, it came at a time with a person who has knowledge. He was there, present when the statements were taken. He recorded them at the time. He Assistant Principal Gallman testified to that. It was in the regular course of an investigation. He was charged by the principal to do these investigations and report back. He would also be a qualified witness under the 8036 to state that, you know, these are the accurate statements, these are what these people said. At this point, you know, I think that we should be able to use them as for summary judgment purposes and have the court look at those.
For the truth.
For the truth of the matter asserted, yes. And I see that my rebuttal time is going into, so.
It's fine.
Thank you.
Mr. Merveld? I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. I apologize.
May it please the court. My name is John Mervildi here on behalf of Carmel Clay Schools. No administrator at Carmel Clay Schools had any idea that MD was being mistreated in any way until February 16, 2010. On that date, the school district began an investigation that culminated that day in the suspension of three of the four alleged perpetrators. And a couple of days later, after more allegations emerged, the fourth perpetrator was suspended. After those initial suspensions, which occurred either hours or days after the school district's administrators first received knowledge of these allegations, none of those four young men ever attended another class at Carmel High School again. It's worth noting, again, that the February 16 knowledge even came through the grapevine. It did not come from MD. It did not come from the Davises, his parents. But the reaction was swift and was severe from the school district. What's really striking about this case, compared to just about all of the cases cited either by the Davises or by me in cases where schools have run into trouble, is just how diametrically opposed we are to, in this case, to what happened in those other cases where administrators for weeks, months, years ignored pleas from parents and students to address these issues. So whether we're talking about Title IX or 1983, the school district handled this matter appropriately when they received knowledge, and ultimately that should bar federal liability under both 1983 and Title IX. I do want to briefly address the evidentiary issues briefly, Your Honor, because you made the two arguments I was going to make. First, on waiver, we first raised this issue in our reply brief. The Southern District of Indiana's local rule does allow a surreply when the reply brief raises issues relating to the admissibility of evidence. The Davises did not respond with a surreply at the trial court. Judge Barker clearly agreed with us in her summary judgment order disregarding this evidence, and the Davises did not raise that in their initial brief before this court, and therefore we would argue that argument is waived. And I want to make clear that all of the allegations relating to Coach Vandenberg, all of the allegations that try to put the knowledge of the school district back in January, are based upon these unsworn statements. Even if we assume for the sake of argument that the Davises have laid the foundation, that these are business records, as you note, we have multiple layers of hearsay. If the issue were whether these statements had been given, whether the school was in possession of these allegations, that would be one thing. But in terms of offering from them for the truth of the matter asserted, this is textbook unsworn statements. The Davises had ample opportunity to depose any of these witnesses. They deposed none of them. So as to Coach Vandenberg, we're left with this fairly vague understanding that he had of an altercation, Your Honor, as you noted, the student involved, who was not MD, there's no evidence that anyone knew anything about what was happening with MD until well into February. The student disclaimed the idea, said it was no big deal, that they were fine. I want to first address the Title IX issue and the issue of knowledge. The Davises more or less concede in their brief that they are making a constructive knowledge argument. They make some effort, again, with these unsworn statements, but assuming those don't come out, that those don't come in, then all that they are left with is this notion that the school should have known because of its supervision requirements, its policies that required the coaches to be present when students were present and that sort of thing. But this court, the Supreme Court, and courts everywhere have always rejected, under these Title IX peer harassment cases, the notion of a standard of constructive knowledge. The school had to have had actual knowledge. And the first instance of actual knowledge that comes into play is the allegation that MD makes, the testimony that MD provides, that he told Coach Blanding, the freshman coach, sometime between the date of the bus incident and February 16th, what had happened to him on the bus. Even accepting MD's account, as we must at the summary judgment stage, the problem is that he concedes also that nothing else happened to him after the conversation with Coach Blanding, which suggests that it was reasonably close in time to February 16th, but also would seem to fall short. The very notion of this Title IX peer harassment liability is the idea of a school having actual knowledge that allows them to prevent these incidents from occurring, and that the school fails to do that. In this case, none of the admissible evidence suggests that there was anything from the point that the school did gain actual knowledge that could have been done to prevent even a single incident. So we would argue that the actual knowledge standard has not been met as to Title IX. In addition, the matter of deliberate indifference on Title IX, as I mentioned briefly in my introductory remarks, this case is about 180 degrees from the cases that are cited, the cases where schools have been held liable under Title IX, where we see instances of students being subjected to anti-gay epithets, and the administrators telling them, well, if you're going to be openly gay, you're just going to have to accept that, or even going along and participating in making fun of them. We've had cases where schools, over the course of multiple school years, have ignored death threats, have simply moved students around rather than impose any serious discipline to protect their students. In this case, all that we have is an immediate response once the administrators know, and even if we take MD's testimony as to Coach Blanding, then within days of MD first saying anything to anyone, even Coach Blanding, who was a part-time school employee who served as freshman basketball coach, it was still a response within a matter of days, whereas many of these cases drag out over the course of years. So on those two points on Title IX, we would respectfully request that the court affirm the district court. I also want to touch, of course, on the 1983 theories. First of all, the Davises make a state-created danger argument under a substantive due process theory. The two means by which a substantive due process claim can be made for the misconduct of third parties would be when there is a special relationship, which generally has been held only, well, not generally, has been held to include only those in the complete custody of the state, such as prisoners or mental patients. Accordingly, the Davises, although they seem to go back to it in their reply brief, acknowledge that there is no such relationship and try to create a state-created danger argument. The problem with that, again, is that the Davises contend that it is inaction on the part of the school district that supports the 1983 state-created danger claim.
With regard to that, for the four seniors, was there a they got a pretty draconian punishment. Was there more than just this incident? Was there, did those, and I'm asking this from two directions, were they already identified as troublemakers or something or other, and this is the last straw, or was this the only thing? I ask that because I have the same question about MD.
I don't believe any of these four students had any disciplinary history. I may be getting a field from the record. I don't remember if that's testified, but there's certainly no evidence in the record that any of them had any disciplinary history. My understanding is that the expulsion was solely based upon these incidents relating to MD and a couple of the other students.
And with regard to MD, there was something I read at least about a number of disciplinary problems, and not only that, but some grade problems.
Yes, and that we discussed in the context of the Title IX theory and whether he'd been deprived of an educational opportunity. But yes, his grades were poor both before, during, and then after he left Carmel High School. There was no appreciable downturn in his grades during the time that he alleges these incidents were happening in the locker room on a regular basis. He also had, I believe, a total of 48 disciplinary referrals during approximately seven semesters that he was enrolled in the Carmel
disciplinary schools. Referrals, 48, you'd you say?
Yes, over the course.
Well, the other thing, focus, is the bus incident. As I think I read, that they were calling his name from the back of the bus, and he went back there. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, and then the other time when they're accusing him of being homosexual, I guess, that's when he announces that he had sex with another student, a girl, in the shower of the school. I'm wondering, in these two types of things, is this something about him that requires that he get more attention? I'm not sure what all this is about. That's why I'm just curious. That's why I asked her about any kind of special education.
No, I don't think there's ever been any evidence that he was ever evaluated for any sort of learning disability or anything that would have brought him within the confines of a special ed circumstance. I don't believe he had an IEP or anything like that. I've at least never seen that in the record, and it appears that Ms. Sheehan agrees with me on that. But one thing I would note is that there is no evidence in the record that they ever called him gay. They had the one unfortunate phrase when he told them what they were doing was gay, and then his response was, "It's not gay unless you come." That is the only phrase that in his testimony, as opposed to in the briefs, that is the only phrase that MD attributes to any of these four seniors. So there is the suggestion in the brief that he said that in response to being called gay or having his sexuality questioned is not supported by MD's testimony, and he's the only one who's given any testimony about what happened in the locker room on that day. But in any event, as to the affirmative act issue, the state-created danger exception to the general rule that that state entities are not responsible for the acts of third parties. If inaction were allowed to support the affirmative act requirement, then state-created danger would quickly become a matter where state law negligence claims would suddenly arise under the substantive due process clause. If inaction were sufficient to constitute an affirmative act, then there would be no point in the limitation of the duty to protect, which also can be characterized as a failure to protect, there would be no point in even having that separate category if the Davises were correct about how it's possible to establish that claim. Finally, I would note that the Davises make a claim under the Equal Protection Clause, also arising through 1983, and the classification that they seek is perceived homosexuality. Again, there is no evidence in the record that even that these four seniors perceived MD as being gay, let alone that the school district perceived MD as being gay, or that any of their treatment or handling of his circumstances were in any way motivated by that. I see that my time is up. I thank the court for your time today.
Thank you. You have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
First, I'd like to address the equal protection claim under 1983, since I didn't address that first. In the case of Seward, they found that an equal protection claim was valid, a perceived homosexuality. In that case, a kid was called faggot and gay, and he was beaten up. The physical act plus the verbal words was enough. In this case, as they were anally penetrating him or trying to, they were saying, it's not gay unless you come. In one case, even the district court agreed, there is evidence that they bent him over a trash can and started banging their genitals against him in a sexual manner, saying, it's not gay unless you come. I think there is enough here to show a perceived homosexuality, or at least an issue of fact, to get to a jury in this case.
But he apparently reported none of this to anybody, parents, other people. It took another student telling his mother to get everybody aware. What was his, I keep coming back to this, what was his own demeanor and his own activity of not raising any of this with his parents or with someone else?
From my conversations with him and from his deposition testimony, he was scared to tell people. He wanted to be part of the team. He wanted to be on the team. He wanted to practice with the team. He would stay at practices and try to get in on scrimmages. He wanted to play basketball, and he did not have the grades, and some of the coaches said the ability to be on that team. Since he's transferred schools, he is on a basketball team, and he did later in his high school education at the numerous schools he was transferred to did make that goal come true, but he just wanted to fit in. He was a freshman trying to fit in with the seniors on the varsity team to get to where he wants to be. It's that pressure of high school, I hate to say it like that, but he just wanted to be part of it.
Well, it seems like you put up with stuff, mm-hmm. and you know, I know as he comes in and announces his activity in the other shower with a girl is to establish that he's not gay, I guess, whatever that was, but it just seems that he was really trying to get attention and be accepted and do some other things. That's why I guess he didn't tell anybody.
And that is what, from his deposition testimony, talking to him, I would conclude as well. I see that my time is up, so I would just like to thank Your Honors for looking at this, and I think we have materials issue of fact to allow us to go to a jury. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sheehan. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.